The Economics of Heritage. Hello, I'm Richard Harwood. I'm a barrister at 39 Essex Chambers.
And I'm Clarissa Levy, Art and Heritage Council at Wedlake Bell.
And we're delighted to have with us today David Tombach, OBE, who is the Development Economics Director at Historic England. Hello, David.
Hello.
David, should we start by explaining how Historic England get involved in the economics of heritage?
Historic England is the government's statutory advisor on the heritage, and we have quite a wide remit. We get involved on listed building applications relating to buildings which are grade one or grade two star. It might be demolition or a change of use where there may be some harm being created. We get involved with applications for planning permission for development, which affects grade one buildings, the setting, etc. Or it may be a scheduled monument or registered battlefield, or maybe even on conservation areas where the development proposed affects the character. So we have quite a wide remit, but mainly it's with grade one and grade two star buildings.
And you can see the role of Historic England advising on whether proposals are beneficial to the heritage, whether there's harm caused. But how do the economics get into those questions, and how does Historic England then get engaged in economic matters?
It will be engaged when the applicant or the owner is putting forward arguments where viability is the key. Most of the time, actually, it's not. It's just simple heritage matters. But sometimes they will say, we need to make a change of use. We need to build more buildings to make our heritage asset economically viable. And that's when I and my colleagues will get involved on economics and viability.
And one of those aspects is where you have potentially very significant harm or demolition, so total loss of significance of the building or asset. And sometimes the rationale is, well, it's not actually possible to save that building. It simply can't be afforded. Do you do that sort of analysis?
One looks at the viability of the building, and in some cases, the building just can't be saved. There isn't a viable future. But for looking at demolition of historic buildings, if it's grade one or grade two star, it's wholly exceptional for that building to be allowed to be demolished. So there has to be really exceptional circumstances. With grade two buildings, again, it's exceptional, but not wholly exceptional. So there is a distinction between grade one and grade two star buildings and grade two. And we are looking at the viability of that building. But the building, its status, whether it's grade one or grade two star or grade two, does not depend upon its viability.
And one of the cases we worked on together now feels like a very long time ago is Greenside, which was a modern movement house built by Conall Ward and Lucas next to, I think it's the 17th Green at Wentworth. So always being commented on by the golf TV commentators, not usually in very flattering terms, but an important grade two listed building. And the owner demolished that and then found his application called in by the Secretary of State for determination. It went to inquiry. And quite a lot of the debate from the owner was to say, well, paraphrasing it to a degree, it didn't make economic sense to keep the building rather than to demolish it and to put up something else in its place.
I remember the case very well indeed, an interesting owner. And here it's a classic example of optimum viable use. The term optimum viable use is that if there is only one use, then that is the optimum viable use. But if there is a range of uses, the optimum viable use is the one that's likely to cause least harm to the significance of the asset. But the optimum viable use may not necessarily be the most economically viable one. And in the case of Greenside, the house was viable. Well, before the gentleman knocked it down, it was had a value, I can't remember off the hand, I think it was a couple of million pounds. But what the owner was arguing is that if he could knock it down, he could build a much bigger house and that would be worth a lot more. And as you know, he failed in that argument. So looking at optimum viable use is one of the things that we do And it's a very interesting topic in itself. There may be situations, and I have a number at the moment, where you have a country house, let's just take a country house, which is viable as a country house, a single dwelling, has magnificent parkland and gardens, but the owner or a new purchaser wants to convert it, say, into a hotel. Now, a hotel is also a good use for many historic buildings, and it's a question of harm. So the advantage of having a hotel is that many more people can go there, visit, enjoy the country house, enjoy the heritage, enjoy the gardens and the landscape. But on the other hand, what is the question of harm? How much harm is going to be caused? Because a hotel obviously needs a certain number of bedrooms, and that leads on to the question of viability of the proposed use. So the existing use, a single house dwelling, is a very good use, but conversely, a hotel could also be a good use, and each case is sort of looked on its merits.
Just looking at the optimum bit before coming to the viable bit there, recognising there's interrelationship. If you change from a single dwelling house to a hotel, that will tend to introduce requirements for all the bedrooms being en suite, appropriate kitchen facilities, and so on. And so changes within that. But what you're saying, is it right thinking that potentially, probably brought to stress potentially, the optimum use could be a use which does involve change, but involves a heritage benefit in actually making the site more accessible by it being an active hotel use to the public?
Yes, each case is different, and I think that I need to stress that. And it depends on the level of harm. If there is going to be minimal or little harm, well, that's fine. It's a question of the degree of harm. If there is going to be what we would consider significant or even substantial harm, then there would need to be market testing to see whether there was anybody out there who would be prepared to buy the property as it is and continue to have it as a house. Most of the houses I'm looking at actually are in poor state of repair. But there are people, there are a number of people out there who aren't worried about the end value. If they buy something for, let's say, £1 million, spend £1 million on it, and they're not worried if at the end of the day it's only worth 1.5, because they love the location, they love the house. It's a project for them, and that you find these people, it's not uncommon. But sometimes when it comes to a business, it becomes far more complicated because the amount of intervention, as you rightly point out, that could be needed. And this question at the end of the day, for Historic England to advise the local authority, remembering it is the local authority who make the decision at the end of the day, as to whether the benefits outweigh the disbenefits.
And it also brings up potentially two ways of looking at viability, depending on the site and the potential purchasers, that when in planning we look at viability in the context of whether a scheme can contribute to affordable housing and the like, the development appraisal will factor in a significant profit margin for the developer to be prepared to go and do the project, and also a price, perhaps we want to come on to back to land value in a moment, but a price that's sufficient for owner to be persuaded to sell to a developer. And so you've got those profit elements in before you can say the scheme may be viable. What you're drawing attention to is that on some projects, if it's the restoration of a single, albeit large, house, you may well have somebody who's prepared to take it on and is able and willing to put the money in to do it, but wouldn't be doing it as an economic proposition because they're seeing that as a family home or something which they are just keen to support.
Absolutely. And I've got many examples where wealthy individuals, and they tend to be wealthy individuals, that they're often people who would like to do the sort of DIY type job there, and they do it themselves. That's on smaller cases. But they are wealthy, they love the location, they love the property, and they will take on a project which economically, I'm a chartered surveyor, from a surveyor's point of view and valuation surveyor, doesn't make sense. Because what I've described before is the love factor. they will pay above and beyond. And although I wasn't able to join in the discussion before, it's the same in some ways with works of art, and in that people will pay. There may be a value for a piece of art, whether it be a porcelain jar, whatever it is, but somebody's prepared to pay way above what other people are prepared to pay because of the fact that they love it. And it is the same with properties. People do love them because often they are in unique locations. And that's why market testing is important, to actually demonstrate to the decision maker whether or not there is anybody out there who would be prepared to take on the property without causing significant or even substantial harm.
Because it's not always about economics.
Correct.
And these things are not investments. I mean, anyone who's ever bought a home knows that. A home is a home, and it's where you rest and recover and find joy. And it's really not necessarily about pounds, shillings and pence.
Clarissa, you're absolutely right. One of the most frequent questions I'm asked is, should I be buying? Am I paying too much? At the end of the day, as you say, it will be your home. And the fact is that you pay what you can afford, obviously what you can afford, but then you spend on it what you want to make it yours. The number of times I've seen people who have spent a fortune decorating their house and fitting it out, but when new owners come in, they just rip everything out. But that doesn't matter because you get what you want.
And it does look a bit like a waste of the planet's resources for a new kitchen to be discarded in favour of another new kitchen just because you'd prefer green to blue.
Absolutely.
I mean, I see your argument about works of art as well. I'm constantly advising people that buying works of art as investments or for just purely financial reasons is really no way to live. And I perhaps shoot myself in the foot professionally. But I mean, I recently turned down a piece of work from a company that wanted to do that, that wanted to buy art so that people could sort of invest in it and it would just be purely a financial asset. And I said, no, that's just not how the economics of these things work. People buy for love.
Personally, I'm a collector, so I can assure you I bought for love as well. And we may talk about this later on, but when we're talking about climate change, the most sustainable building is the one that's already built. The embodied energy is there. And if they can be reused, and that's another main part of my work, which is repurposing historic buildings, then that for the planet is the best thing rather than creating new buildings.
In the context of repurposing, how far are we looking at viability and a viable use? Do we need to look at, well, whether it is long-term viable, whether that's putting in an income source which will keep the building?
It becomes very difficult when one's doing development appraisals or business plans for building because there are so many factors, variables. And a development appraisal is only a snapshot in time, and nobody knows what's going to happen in the future. One of the more interesting sort of areas is the question of the adaptations that's needed. If, for example, we take a country house, because it's a good example, and it's going to be converted into a hotel. As you mentioned earlier, it's going to need kitchens that are sufficient to cater for the number of visitors. Hotels, different types of hotels have different requirements for the number of rooms they need. So it might require additional accommodation built outside the main house and in maybe the stables. I've got a case at the moment where they want to convert the stables, historic grade 2-star stables, into accommodation, but also build lodges in the surrounding parkland within the things quite well discreetly put away, so won't affect the setting, but does affect the parkland. And that is a business model. We've looked at the business model. The business model seems to work for this firm. But what happens in 5-10 years' time? And we all know that, like all businesses, hotels are risky businesses to set it up. And it fails. Then what happens to the building? The chance of it then reverting back to a single dwelling is small, so it might be another hotel operator. And that hotel operator may say, well, you've got 50 bedrooms, we need 100 to make it work for us. So what do you do then? Do you start building more accommodation in the grounds? And if the building, and I have a number of examples of this, when a hotel, and I'm just using hotels as an example, when a hotel starts to fail, the sort of decorations, repairs, start to deteriorate. One could look at private schools. Again, private schools are businesses, they're competing with each other, and parents require not only an education but good facilities for their children. And they may say, we need to build a swimming pool in the grounds, we need to build this, we need to build more accommodation, etc. So the business side of it, and going on to this long term, one can't guarantee, but when the decision is made, the decision maker, and we obviously feed into that, needs to carry out proper due diligence using expert advice to give us the best chance of making the right decision for the building.
I think you're drawing attention to two possible problems. One is that a use comes in and then makes various changes to the building to accommodate it, develops in the grounds and so on. And then that use essentially fails. And there is a new operation where we said hotel operating a different fashion, or it's an entirely different use which will come in, which will then make its own changes, which are unhelpful. So you get a series of not terribly helpful changes, but the future of the building is still precarious. And the other possibility to draw attention to, the private schools analogy, is in a sense not a use that fails, but a use that's actually successful but needs to evolve. And there then becomes the ongoing pressure on that situation, more facilities on a site which is incredibly historically sensitive.
Absolutely. Another classic case I've come across are retirement homes. I've seen historic buildings converted into flats for retirement homes, which on the face of it are absolutely wonderful. They're really idyllic in the countryside. People have their own spaces. They think they will downsize from a nice house into a two-bedroom or a three-bedroom retirement home within a block. There are people on site to look after them, restaurants, facilities, etc. And they buy long leases of these flats, but then find that the service charge, and that's a really critical part of it, the service charge goes up, the cost of repairs goes up, and they're faced with significant bills. And in some cases, the company finds themselves in problems, not being able to provide the services that have been promised, and service charges, which mean that the units themselves are unsaleable. It doesn't happen that often, but it is another example where viability of the end use is important. When it comes to non-historic buildings, then the decision maker needn't be so worried, because the effect isn't so dramatic. But on historic buildings, of course, they are protected, and we are looking to do our best to ensure that they do have long-term beneficial uses, which the majority of them do.
And you've got to assess then the businesses.
Then we are looking at, as best we can, the business model. We look to the track record of the individual. I will give you an amusing sort of tale. There was a site where I met a potential owner who wanted to convert this property into a five-star restaurant. And that was a possibility. It was a little bit out of sight and attractive, very nice views. I could see what they were going to try and do. When I asked the gentleman about his experience, he informed me that he'd dined in some of the finest restaurants in the world. And that was his sole experience. I says, have you ever run a restaurant? No, he hadn't. But he had eaten very well. And that doesn't really fill me with confidence that this gentleman actually understands the business model of a restaurant, which you've only got to look on television and see how the restaurants are run. They are complex, they are hard work, and they are dependent upon reputation. And another example might be wedding venues. My own son was married in a Grade II listed mansion with a deer park, and it was a really slick operation. We went in, there were about 50 rooms, something like that. People stayed overnight, our guests, and there was a marquee. But as we were leaving, another wedding party was coming. So it was a very well-run operation, a very good use of a Grade II listed building. But the problem with these sort of businesses, they are dependent upon reputation. Reputations can, particularly in the wedding business, can be quite fragile.
One other aspect of viability is the value of the original site, so the value of the land and the building. And how that's taken into account in the context, which we'll often have, of a historic building which would need an awful lot of work being done to it, got quite run down, potentially a lot of space around it. If you got rid of the building, you'd have potentially quite a large development site. The owner would like to be getting something for it. How do you look at the land values on a site with those sort of conflicting aspects to it?
The one piece of advice I would give to anybody buying a historic property is to pay the right price. And then the question comes is, what is the right price? The right price is the value of the property once it has been put into optimum viable use, having regard to the planning constraints that are attached to the property, the historic building, and you just can't do anything you might want to immediately without consent, but also the condition of the property. And if an owner pays too much for the property and overpays, the planning system is not there to bail them out, because that would lead to, in some individuals, not all obviously, but some individuals allowing their properties to be neglected, letting it get in poor condition and not worrying about what they will get for it at the end of the day. So the planning system is structured whereby if somebody, certainly from the historic point of view, if they pay too much for the site, and again, we can discuss that a bit further, then they can't sort of get their money back because they've made a mistake.
And the concept of a conservation deficit has been, certainly recall it being discussed over the years. What does that mean? Is the owner entitled to expect something for the value of their property if they've let it on to rack and ruin?
If there is a conservation deficit, and a conservation deficit is where the end value of the property exceeds the cost of putting that property into a reasonable state of repair. So a simple example, if a property has a end value in reasonable repair of £1 million, but if the cost of putting that property into that state is £1.5 million, then there is a conservation deficit of £500,000. That's in very simplistic terms. So conservation deficits do exist, but even with the conservation deficit, there can be land value, because again, going back to our example of a country house, there may be a stable block, there may be land that in its own right has got value, because legally there is nothing to stop an owner disposing of part of the land, so it could have value. What we set out in our enabling development guidance, good practice advice number 4, GPA 4, is that what we are certainly against is owners drawing a red line around the historic asset, which may have a deficit, and then just arguing that there's deficit because that's all they own, but they still own the other land. And that is something which we highlight within the guidance.
David, do you want to take us through what's meant by enabling development and then look at how effective it is?
Enabling development is development that would not be in compliance with local or national planning policies and would not normally be given planning permission, except for the fact that it would secure the future conservation of a heritage asset. And so it's really development that just wouldn't normally be allowed, but because there is a conservation deficit, then yes, under certain circumstances, enabling development, which could be development in the grounds of maybe some houses, that's the classic that we face, would be allowed by the local authority. But the monies raised from that will be put towards the repair of the main heritage asset. That's the key. It's a very useful tool. It's a legitimate planning tool, but one has to be careful because it is a last resort. It's irreversible, and enabling development is an inefficient method of raising funds, because what one is actually utilizing is the uplift in value of land which otherwise may be pasture land, arable land, but can be turned into building land.
And it's also bearing in mind that the developer who's going to be carrying this out, this is not a we're talking about enabling development, we're not talking about an individual doing a project for love on a particular property. It's going to be a sizable developer to build the X units or whatever it is, that they've got to make a profit for it to be worth doing. And it's what's left after they've done all the works, they've made the profit, the owner has got whatever return is appropriate to them. It's the profit element that's left from all that, which can then be used for the restoration of the historic asset. So you're getting quite a lot of development for a small proportion of the value, which can then be spent on the restoration.
That's absolutely correct. And GPA4, as I've mentioned, is the Historic England guidance on that, a good advice note, and it covers all the scenarios. It's not straightforward. It's not easy. I have likened it to pushing a heavy boulder up a hill. And the reason why is it's not easy is because we are dealing with something which is contrary to either local or national planning policies. So it's right that it should be not an easy process. On the other hand, under certain circumstances, it can be the process by which a historic house or historic asset can be saved for the nation and brought back into long-term beneficial use. The problem comes when the development appraisals halfway through, we have a change of the market. The market might collapse, and the developer then says, well, you gave us permission for 50 houses, but now we need 80 houses, which we need to build here, which is right in the middle of the historic landscape. So there are problems, and it's not straightforward when dealing with these situations.
I think what that brings out is both the difficulty of getting something right that's right and workable, and also the way in which the local authority and Historic England need to be engaged, on particularly on the important sites at quite an early stage. I mean, how does Historic England get involved on the pre-planning application stage?
Well, we welcome early engagement. Early engagement is something that we encourage. If there is particularly going to be a development, we would point to our Enhanced Advisory Services, EAS, because we have there a major project service, and that can give the developer, the owner, a package of services tailored to their needs under a service level agreement. It also covers a listed screening service, which provides clarity on access areas facing developments, identifies other buildings on site that might be candidates for listing, and we can give constructive advice. The way it works is that we, together with the local authority, will work as a team, hopefully. It doesn't always happen, but 99 times out of 100, we will work very constructively with the local authority, and we will be able to help the owner, developer, with their proposals. The one thing that it's worth remembering is that what we want is that the building is brought back into long-term beneficial use. We don't want to see redundant buildings deteriorating, because an empty building deteriorates, and I've seen it so many times, so very quickly. Once a building is unoccupied, they really go downhill very quickly. And whether it be from vandalism, whether it be just the fact that if there's a leaky roof, it doesn't take long for rot to set in. So empty buildings are not good things, and we encourage buildings to be brought back into use.
One final topic is climate change and renewable energy, and to what extent is that affecting how we deal with keeping of heritage buildings into long-term use, and how's Historic England looking at those issues from your perspective?
I've been qualified as a chartered surveyor this December, 50 years, and during that time I've seen many changes, but I can honestly say the last 10 years possibly, I have never seen as much interest or change when it comes to climate change. There has been an awakening that this is actually happening, and I think that the previous government and our current government as well take this exceedingly seriously, as does Historic England. It's one of our top priorities. I don't know if you know, but the United Kingdom has the oldest building stock in Europe, with 11 million properties in London and Wales alone, over a quarter of which are over 100 years old. And we've also done a lot of research and improvements to historic buildings, and homes can deliver 30% of the carbon reductions required by what is known as the sixth carbon budget. So it's not a question of if change can be accommodated, but how. As I mentioned before, the most sustainable building is the one that's already built. And by having continued proper repair, maintenance, use and reuse of historic buildings, it avoids unnecessary release of embodied carbon associated with materials, transport, etc. So in order to help people, local authorities, we brought out only in July of this year a guidance. It's a note. It's called Adapting Buildings for Energy and Carbon Efficiency. And it's a Historic England advice note, number 18. And if people would like to look at that, it's very readable. It's got some exceedingly good examples of how to use photovoltaic cells, how to make your buildings more efficient, energy efficient, and that's online.
David, thank you. You've drawn attention to a couple of those Historic England documents. I mean, Historic England's advice is a great resource. It's also actually frequently a great read about whatever it is, whether it's commemorative sculpture or its particular forms of industrial buildings, as well as how to look at the issues. David, thank you so much for joining us, drawing on your nearly 50 years experience in the profession and the many historic cases which you've been involved in. Thank you very much. Thank you for listening to the Art and Heritage Law Contested Heritage. Please do follow or subscribe on Apple or Spotify podcasts to enjoy more shows.
We have a new podcast out every fortnight. If you're able, please take the time to rate us and put down a review.
The show is also on the 39 Essex Chambers website, along with podcast series on topics such as artificial intelligence, climate change, and planning.